686-2237. Secure your future and call 1-800-686-2237.
Now you can enjoy the most delicious, freshest, and healthiest drinking water anytime, even while traveling, during outdoor sporting activities, and in hospital filtration environments such as local or national emergencies. The revolutionary Berkey Light removes pathogenic bacteria, cysts, parasites, and harmful or unwanted chemicals to below detectable levels. It also removes foul tastes and odors like that rotten egg smell of sulfide, and it reduces nitrates and unhealthy minerals like lead and mercury while leaving in the healthful and nutritional minerals your body needs.
You're listening to the Global Star Radio Network, located at Telstar 5 KU band, frequency 11836, symbol rate 20770. Thank you for listening.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Dr. Dennis Cuddy. And Dr. Cuddy's taught at the university level, testified before Congress, worked within corporate America doing analysis. He is certainly one of the country's leading authors, a number of books, which we one day I hope we can get back into print. But right now, of course, we do carry a number of his books on mental health screening, on the timeline for the New World Order from an educational point of view, on the road to socialism. And certainly you can go to our website or call our 800 number and ask about the books that Dr. Cuddy has written. But you can read his articles every week, every other week, at newswithviews.com. And I think we're going to be talking about his latest article, which goes into the background of the impact of music on our society. Is that what we're going to talk about today, Dennis, or what are we going to talk about?
Yes.
Okay, well, then you pick up the story.
As usual, I try to have some sort of comment on subjects of the day, and so all over the news recently, President Obama has been pushing for a vote by August on the health care bill. Now, the latest word is he won't get it, but they're really trying, Rahm Emanuel especially, for at least a vote in the House. Yeah, that's H.R. 3200. It's titled America's Affordable Health Choices Act. And we don't have time to go into that whole bill, but I would just urge your listeners to look at Section 102. And there's a small A, grandfathered health insurance coverage defined. And then under that, number one is limitation on new enrollment. And under that is A in general. I'm just going to read this A in general. Except as provided in this paragraph, the individual health insurance issuer offering such coverage does not enroll any individual in such coverage if the first effective date of coverage is on or after the first day of Y1, that's year one of the plan. Some people have interpreted that as really the end to your own coverage, despite what they're saying. They don't say you may not have your coverage, but the effect of this would be if you want to have new health insurance on your own, you can't get it. And so there's all kinds of pitfalls, if you look carefully at this legislation, moving us toward national health insurance.
And, of course, they're lying when they say everything's going to be as it was before. But no. If you lose your insurance, you're not going to be able to get new insurance other than the government plan.
That's right.
And that's what they really don't want the American people to know. And this is all about rationing access to health care. And logic tells you there's no way to increase the number of people covered, 46 million. And actually, it's going to save money by increasing the number of people in these programs. Go right ahead.
Right. Well, like I said, I don't want to spend a lot of time, but what you just said about rationing health care and no, you won't have your own insurance plan. Just look at section 102, small letter A, under that number one, under that large letter A. And that may be the place where they're trying to sneak that in. Do I hear the music?
You hear the music? We've got about 30 seconds.
Okay, well, the beginning of my article, as usual, I have a note. And on there, I'm talking about one of the books that Radio Liberty carries of mine, The Road to Socialism and the New World Order. And at the front of it is the Fabian Socialist Window with an inscription, Remold It Nearer to the Heart's Desire. And we'll see how that applies to President Obama.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment with Dr. Dennis Cuddy, right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess, this afternoon. Dr. Dennis Cuddy, taught at the university level, testified before Congress, worked in the Reagan administration in the Department of Education, but is certainly a researcher, certainly one of our favorite guests. We're talking about his latest article, which you can find up on newswithviews.com, that's newswithviews.com, about the impact of music on society. And the article begins talking about referring to a window. It's actually it is the Fabian Socialist Window. It's the Beatrice Webb window, stained glass window, which was at it was the headquarters of the International Socialist Movement, and that was at Ombury, St. Mary, about 50 miles south of London. And we actually went down there, and they had pictures of the window. And there you see a picture of George Bernard Shaw and Sidney Webb, and they're pounding on an anvil. They've got the globe sitting on top of the anvil, and above that, the caption, mold it to your heart's desire. In other words, remold the world, and this is what the Fabian Socialists are doing. They're changing the world, and Mr. Obama is going right along with it. You pick up the story there.
Sure, and it's, the whole history of that thing's interesting. The window was commissioned in 1910, some 20 at least, years after the beginning of the Fabian Socialist movement. It's since left that. I think now it's currently in some California state somewhere, but for a long time it was there. It's a stained glass window. Down at the bottom you have a list of them and of the books and plays and so forth that they would use to remold the society nearer to their heart's desire. Over at the left-hand side is H.G. Wells, who's thumbing his nose at the rest of them, not because he disagreed with them. He was a Fabian Socialist, one of the early ones, but he just felt they should come out in the open. That's why he wrote books like The Open Conspiracy, Blueprints for World Revolution. And the term remold it nearer to the heart's desire, strangely enough, or maybe not so strangely, came from an old Ismaili poem, Omar Khayyam. And I put that in my Now is the Dawning of the New Age, New World Order book. So here you have some origins of radical Islamic terrorist types who had hooked up with the Knights Templar, the assassins, and so forth. And lo and behold, look who the Fabians go to for their signatory message there. Remold it near to the heart's desire.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, our guest, of course, is Dr. Cuddy, talking about, of course, this slogan of the Fabian Socialists. They're going to remold the world to their heart's desire. And they are in the process of doing it, but they're doing it very slowly. They're doing it by stealth. They're talking about compassion for people. It's all about control. Socialism is a beautiful theory. It's a sincere, benevolent, idealistic theory, but it doesn't work because somebody has to be in control. And so basically this is why people of great wealth who want to establish a feudal society push socialism, and all these idealists swarm and say, oh, isn't it wonderful, we're going to redistribute the wealth, without understanding you're not going to redistribute the wealth. You're establishing a feudal society with the people of great wealth ruling this feudal society. Go right ahead.
Sure. And then this happens. I mean, you can trace it on back. At the front of my book that you offer at Radio Liberty, The Road to Socialism and the New World Order, after that cover page back where I have a picture of the Fabian window, I go into some of the background as to how, I mean, you could start with Charlemagne, and then you come on down to the time of the French Revolution, and there's one of his ancestors, and, you know, it's all supposed to be about liberté, égalité, fraternity, you know, the people overthrowing the shackles of authority, authority meaning monarchical authority or religious authority, the church as well, any type of authority. Of course, what they didn't tell them is that that revolution, as most revolutions, including the communist revolutions, were really instigated by these elite. They call themselves philosopher kings. You know, we are the best and the brightest, and so leave it to us. We will tell you peasants what to do. I mean, you could say that now. You could say 100 years ago, 200, 300, 400. It's the same story right from the beginning. It's always that way. But they don't want to portray it that way, you know, often. They say, oh, yes, the people, government of, by, and for the people, which is really not what we have. It's, you know, that's what they say. So anyway, remold it nearer to the heart's desire. They picked that up of all the places they could pick it up from. They pick it from Omar Khayyam way back at the Ismaili story and so on. And so now we look at today, and so I ask, is it any wonder that President Obama's policies are moving us towards socialism when at a town hall meeting in Arnold, Missouri on April 29, just 2-3 months ago, he said, quote, we're working to remake America. All right, so that's his quote. He will remake, another word for that's remold, America, it, remold it, nearer to his heart's desire. And the reason I say his heart's desire is because he always says things like, well, it's not about me. It's about the American people. It's all about the American people. But when you look at all of his statements and his speeches, I have a plan. We need to institute my plan. I will not do this. I will not do, you know, it's I. But then when he wants to sound really benevolent, and there is a book that I mentioned in some of my works called Our Benevolent Feudalism, which is what, I mean, this is what the guy is there for. That's what he's doing. Our Benevolent Feudalism, written by W.J. Gint, who was editor of the American Fabian magazine in the late 1800s. This is their fellow today. You know, this is a culmination of what they were interested in. And so the terms are basically the same as the Fabian socialist, remake, remold, whatever, you know. And so this is why he's increasingly moving us towards a socialist nation. Now, you may say, oh, well, you know, you're just speculating. You know, you're taking these words and making a whole theory out of it. Well, why don't you look let's say, his appointment of Carol Browner as assistant to the president for energy and climate change. Now, this is very important, you know, global warming, climate change, big issue. We have to revamp our entire energy structure. We have to go green, you know, all this. This is a big, big aspect of Obama's administration. So who's he pick? He picks Carol Browner. Well, what has she been a member of? She's been a member of Socialist International, of all things. Their Commission for a Sustainable World Society. There's actually a photo of her addressing Socialist International's 23rd Congress in Athens, Greece, just this past June, about a year ago. Now, of course, when she, you know, got the word that she may be up for an appointment, she resigned right after that conference. But up until then, there's a picture of her, Socialist International. And she's also, of course, a strong supporter of what's called cap and trade. The carbon emission controls, and everybody who knows anything about that knows that that's going to just send even more American jobs overseas. So the idea that he's moving us towards socialism is not far-fetched. I mean, you know, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, General Motors, AIG, you know, all of these things being taken over, and here one of his major efforts is headed by a member of Socialist International. So this isn't just idle speculation. Plus, if you look at the Fabian socialist, George Bernard Shaw, who Dr. Stan mentioned a few minutes ago, he said they, the Fabian socialists, set out to, this is what he said, educate, agitate, organize. All right, that's what he said. Educate, that's a quote. Educate, agitate, organize. All right, relevant to organize, Obama was a community what? Organizer. Following the model of Saul Alinsky, who authored Rules for Radicals. He also, back in the 40s, did Reveille for Radicals. And as we mentioned before, Rules for Radicals has an acknowledgement to Lucifer at the front. You know, I mean, I don't care how good a person is or an idea they have. If they got an acknowledgement to Lucifer, I'm not going to support them. Now, relevant to educate, John Lloyd, he was former executive director of the Kansas National Education Association. So this is an inside guy. He said that this Alinsky book, Rules for Radicals, has been the, quote, Bible, quote, of the National Education Association, the NEA. And relevant to the final word of what George Bernard Shaw said there about, he said regarding agitate, Alinsky wrote that the radical organizer, quote, dedicated to changing the life of a particular community must first rub raw the resentments of the people of the community, fan the latent hostilities of many of the people to the point of overt expression. He must search out controversy and issues. An organizer must stir up dissatisfaction and discontent, end quote. Now,
I think a beautiful example of that would be that when the president goes on television yesterday and condemns the police there that who had arrested one of his friends, you know, and of course because the friend happened to be black and he'd had an altercation with the police officer who just wanted to make sure somebody wasn't breaking into his home. And of course, now certainly Barack Obama took a lot of heat on that because it looked like he was a racist. In fact, it was his friend that was creating the ruckus, not the police officer. And now Obama's backing down, and he's even talking to the police officer. What a fine man he was! But basically, of course, Obama was trying to drum up racial hatred, turning black against white and white against black. And I think it backfired on him, fortunately.
Well, if you look at, I don't want to get too much into guilt by association until I check this out, but I'll just refer to something about Henry Louis Gates. Before Gates went to Harvard in 1991, he spent a couple of years down where I am in this area at Duke University. And I've mentioned on your program before, in 1987, Accuracy in Academia had a really good article called Duke Welcomes Marxists. And I mentioned before, and you know, I'll mention it again maybe, how they were bragging over the previous, say, 20 years or so, how many wonderful Marxist professors they had joined the faculty. It was just so wonderful. And they were holding the Southeastern Convention of whatever Marxists. I can go grab the thing in a minute. But anyway, and so this is in 87, and here comes Gates down from Cornell 2 years later. Now, I'm not saying Gates is a, quote, Marxist, but I got a hunch that he wasn't too unsympathetic with these people who he came down and decided to join the faculty of. We'll put it that way. So anyway, I'll have to check into that a little further. But that's Gates's background. He's a very interesting person. And so what you have then is this statement by Alinsky. It applies directly to Obama. Obama has been a radical organizer, quote, dedicated to changing, quote, America, which is now headed down the path towards socialism as desired by the Fabians. It's fairly simple, straightforward.
But I think people have to understand this is really fascism. It is an all-powerful state, and the people simply lose control of their lives.
Well, let me, since you brought that up, let me sort of tweak that a little, refine it. What they do is there are stages of this. The main theory that I have presented over many years is that the communism was a construct to play off against an antithesis to the thesis of capitalism, because what they ultimately wanted was socialism, a world socialist government, as displayed by Auguste Comte, Saint-Simon, and these guys coming out of the French Revolution, these philosopher kings. And it goes back further than that, but that's a good starting point. And so what they do is they develop an aspect of socialism called fascism, which is really sort of a sneaky way to do something very, very specific. What you have is that 1911 cartoon where you have not only J.P. Morgan, John D. Rockefeller, Andrew Carnegie, but also Teddy Roosevelt. See, it's not just the elite business types, it's the political person. They're one of their pawns, Teddy Roosevelt, just like Woodrow Wilson was. And they're all welcoming Karl Marx. And this is to Wall Street, and under his arm is not a book called called Communism, it's called Socialism. And after the break, I'll explain it.
All right, and Chris, you can see that picture. It's in the front page of a book we carry called Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution. And until the American people understand that it was Wall Street that financed the Bolshevik Revolution, we can't let the American people know that, the common people, they'd begin to see what the scam this is. But, of course, it goes into how the money for Lenin was coming from the Federal Reserve Board and major American corporations, including those associated with the Rockefellers. And that's why the Rockefeller Foundation financed the communist movement here in America. Until that, you understand that, nothing really makes sense. Go right ahead, Dr. Cuddy.
Okay, and that cartoon is, I put that in some of my books. They're saying, delighted to Karl Marx. It's in Secret Records Revealed and the Globalist and so on. And Federal Reserve, William Boyce Thompson, put $1 million of his own money into the Communist revolution there with Trotsky and Lenin. And then there's a little clipping I have, a little teeny thing, the New York Times around 1920, where Lenin is very open, said, oh yeah, we got to have money from these big shots or our revolution's just going to fall apart. Now, this is 3 years after. I mean, it's not just, you know, that, oh good, they gave us some money and now we're in control. I mean, it was just, they knew it was a disaster unless they maintained the funding of these people. And that's why, you know, they had Raymond Robbins, these guys, American Red Cross, supposedly, over there. And then Arm & Hammer giving all these, you know, sweetheart deals with Occidental Petroleum and other mining interests in the 20s. You know, all of these Soviet leaders, dear Comrade Hammer, you know, they're all signing, they're real buddies. They roll out literally the red carpet for Armand Hammer, and then when they come through and so forth. So it was maintained. It's not just that they funded and, oh, look, they had a revolution. They have constantly propped that failed system up.
And, of course, I think people have to understand Averell Harriman, Henry Ford. I mean, so many of our major capitalists were financing the communist revolution. But we can't let the American people know that. And that's why, of course, during the Vietnam War, when, of course, our flyers were flying over the Ho Chi Minh Trail there and looking down, they saw these Ford motor trucks there carrying the weapons from North Vietnam to South Vietnam that were going to be used to kill American boys. They were Ford trucks. They were built at the Ford plant in Gorky in Russia. And Ford kept updating that so they would have the latest technology. But the American people have no idea how we financed the North Vietnamese all during the Vietnam War so we could keep the war going. After all, we couldn't have the Americans win the war and come home, could we? Go right ahead.
No. And actually, Yankelevich took a poll. I've been over that before. He had Philip Freneau back in 1792 in this article about how this elite would come to control things again. And part of that was to lose war, because by losing wars, you wipe out national pride, national patriotism, which opens the way for more of a globalist bent. You know, we are now all world citizens, like Obama says, and so on. But anyway, so after this 1911 cartoon, and they pull their shenanigans with the Federal Reserve in 1913, and they get their flunky Woodrow Wilson in there and so on, there's something lacking. Something's lacking. Now, one of the things that was lacking is they knew there was this big outcry against, the monopolies, as they call them. John D. Rockefeller would go around handing little children little dimes, you know, and that's supposed to make him be loved. but the people still didn't, you know, like these big money guys were controlling things. Even I've used quotes from John Swinton, the editorial page editor of the New York Times, formerly saying, we're all a bunch of he called himself. He said, we're all the press. We're prostitutes. That's what we are. We don't dare issue the truth, our own opinions, and so forth. We're bought. We're bought by these big shots. And so, but something's lacking, see? So what they had to do was have a, quote, trust buster, you know, like Teddy Roosevelt, who really all he did was break this, you know, this monster into a multi-headed hydra, which is more difficult. But don't worry, you know, they had interlocking directorates, so it amounted to the same thing. It's just more difficult, you know. Instead of one villain, you had seven or eight villains you had to keep tabs on and watch what they were up to. And so that was one solution to this problem of the perception of the public against these
guys. Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, Dr. Cuddy is doing talk about how the large corporations here in the United States at the beginning of the last century were all financing and helping communism. And then there was a lot of outcry from the American people. And so they brought in Teddy Roosevelt, the trust box buster, and he would take something like, the Rockefeller of Oil, Standard Oil, he'd bust it into six or seven different branches of Standard Oil that all have interlocking directorates. They were all controlled by the same people. But then there was Standard Oil of New York and Standard Oil of California and Standard Oil of Indiana and Ohio. And everybody said, oh, look, they've broken up Standard Oil. They really didn't, of course. They controlled Chase Manhattan Bank. That's J.P. Morgan Chase today. They controlled Citibank. These are the Rockefeller interests. But, of course, the average individual doesn't understand how they control, and they do to this very day, most of our airlines, and many of our airlines, many of our pharmaceutical, and the major banks and the major energy producers, and, of course, they control and own many of our politicians. But go right ahead.
Right. Okay. So, now, if they're going to do that, if they're going to have this multi-headed hydra and therefore offshoots of various corporations and subsidiaries and whatever with interlocking directorates, what you got to do is develop something else. It no longer was good enough to have capitalism and this antithesis of communism to get your socialism. If you're going to create these sort of lesser entities, major corporations but not the biggest, lots of these secondary, we'll call them secondary but major corporations. If you're going to create these things, what you needed was a mechanism to fulfill your plan. And that's where fascism comes in. Because what you have to do, and what they did, well, I won't belabor how that happened originally, but bring it up to today. So what you want to do then is, through this new mechanism in the U.S. of fascism, you say, oh, look, globalism will make all of this progress for all of you. That's the primary and the secondary corporations. Now, remember, the secondary doesn't mean small. By secondary, I'm meaning really, really big corporations, but not the top, not directly controlled by a Rockefeller or somebody like that. So you got to enlist all of these sub-level created entities, and you got to get them interested in globalization. Say, ooh, look at all that profit you can get if you, get factories over in China and cheap labor and all that stuff. They say, oh, goody, And so they push for NAFTA and GATT and so forth. But really, that's a ploy that they're using. So they get them extended out all over the place, right, globally, right, which is what you want. You want this global economic system. And then what you do is you have them linked up with the government, and that's your fascism. Your corporations in general, all of them, not just the Rockefeller guys, but in general, linked up with the government, and there's your fascism. But then what happens is the really big shots, the Rockefeller types, then they pull the rug out from under with this economic global crisis. You pull the rug out from under these secondary institutions as you transition from fascism into socialism, which is what that cartoon was, just the big shots, the Rockefeller, the big shots, having undercut the competition just below them, these sub-created entities that were, supposedly are originated out of the trust busting or whatever. I mean, they're not directly. They're separate corporations, but they're second level. And so you cut the rug out from under them, wiping out competition. You grab up everything, you can. You get, the media is controlled, all this sort of stuff. Fewer and fewer and fewer and fewer hands. And so then what you are able to do is the really big shot, the Rockefeller types, through their control of politicians, then transition from fascism to socialism. And that's what Obama is doing. That's what the General Motors, the Fannie Mae, the Freddie Mac, the AIG, and that sort of stuff is doing. This is a transition period from the fascism, towards socialism, which will be the ultimate goal. And that's why you got, Carol Browner, and she's, Socialist International. And most of the heads of state of Europe are, they have a secondary title. They may be president or prime minister, whatever, some country, but they also have the title of vice president of Socialist International, with Carol Browner. So anyway, that's how that is coming about. So, Lastly, I put here under my introductory note to the article, one way to recognize a socialist nation is to look at the relation of government to private business. Government takeover of General Motors, for example. And relevant to that is the fact that the corporate tax rate in the U.S. is even higher than that in Sweden, which is recognized as an obviously very socialist nation. So when you look at these specific criteria, you can see this isn't conjecture. We are moving that way, and Obama is the primary vehicle for the power elite to use today.
And I love it when the president says why we don't want to run the automotive company, or we're putting in the whole board on our own. Of course, we're going along and closing down the dealerships. We're telling them, of course, which of their plants to close down. Close down the one up in Milpitas here. Close down the Hummer plant, the Subaru plant, the the Pontiac plant, all the plants. You do what we say because we're in control. Well, Dr. Cuddy, you go right ahead.
Okay, that's the end of the note I have at the first of the article, and to the main body, I begin by saying we know that music can have a profound effect on people. And, of course, certain types of music can have a very calming or soothing effect. However, according to Oliver Sacks, he's a professor of neurology and psychiatry at Columbia University Medical Center, he says, quote, music of a particular sort can actually trigger seizures, end quote. And I have a link there so you can actually see the article where he's saying that. Now remember, we're not just talking about something stimulating you. You know, oh, you got some patriotic music, so you start marching. We're talking about the power of music is so great that it can actually trigger a seizure. Now, that's powerful. So what I do is I start looking at, as I usually do, in historical terms. In Plato's Republic, which is where a lot of this stuff comes from, you know, this philosopher king stuff, he stated that, quote, the introduction of a new kind of music can alter the character of a nation, end quote. Now, once again, he's not just saying, you know, let's have some upbeat music. A new kind of music alters the character of a whole nation. So when a certain type of music comes to the fore, it doesn't just happen. You know, somebody just doesn't say, "Oh, look, I'm tapping my toe," and you know, "Gee, look what I discovered here." These things are all planned way in advance. Plato knew it. All of these people know what they're doing, and so what they're doing actually through music in the 20th century was a what I call an assault upon traditional American moral values. And it began in general with the permissiveness of the Roaring Twenties. You had sort of, you know, standard fare before that, but the Roaring Twenties, it was, you know, liberation, and they're all, you know, doing the Charleston and, you know, all sort of, and by liberation, I mean sexual liberation. There's a lot of promiscuities going on in the 20s. And if you doubt that, look at the lyrics of a popular 1921 song called The Sheik of Araby. I mean, just, you know, you can find this online. Look at the lyrics. And this is a popular song. Now, in previous columns, I have already quoted from Antonio Gramsci, who was active in the 20s, John Dewey, active in the 20s, Edward Bernays, active in the 20s, concerning their role.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, Dr. Cuddy's picking up his thought on his latest article at News with Views, and that is the impact of music on society. And of course, it's been known for really for thousands of years that music can influence and transform a society. And of course, Dr. Cuddy starts out talking about certainly the Roaring Twenties. Of course, this was the time there's all sorts of money, the Federal Reserve System expanding the monetary supply, wild and raucous activity, the time of the speakeasy, the time of Prohibition, and then the revolt against Prohibition. But there was a beginning of the moral breakdown of our society. At that time, and sexual promiscuity was coming coming to the fore. So pick up the story there, Dr. Cuddy.
Sure. If you look at movies, you know, Thoroughly Modern Millie. Now, you know, it's a comedy and all, but if you look at the undercurrent of that, women are becoming, you know, very liberated. They're starting to smoke, and dresses are getting very, very short, and, you know, they're liberated, and they should be able to do whatever they want to do and so on. So I've quoted in the past Antonio Gramsci and John Dewey and Edward Bernays, who were very active during this period and regarding their roles in altering societies and values. And in this particular column, I'm going to focus on what music had to do with this. So after the Roaring Twenties gets going, in 1934, you have the bisexual Cole Porter introducing a popular musical and song by the title Anything Goes. And, you know, you can imagine what it has. But if just go online, you can find the lyrics, Anything Goes, Anything Goes, which was about a shift away from the restrictive codes of conduct that had been prior to that. And then 2 years later, 1936, you have Irving Berlin. Now, Irving Berlin is known for, you know, patriotic songs and This is the Army, you know, and rousing tunes. But that's not all Irving was up to. He composed the music and lyrics for the motion picture in that year of 1936 called Follow the Fleet. And it stars Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. I think Randolph Scott's also in it. And there's another person. The love interest of Randolph Scott is Harriet Hilliard. Now, your listeners probably, who's Harriet Hilliard? Well, she is later to become Harriet Nelson of Ozzy and Harriet fame. So here we are. We're back in the 30s, right? Back in 1936. And she's singing a song from this movie. It has her, you know, she's sort of walking outside, looking off into the night and so on. And these are the lyrics. I'm going to read these lyrics. Quote, this is a quote. She's singing this song. Get thee behind me, Satan, but the moon is low and I can't say no. Get thee behind me, Satan, but the moon is low and I may let go. Get thee behind me. Someone I'm mad about is waiting in the night for me. Someone that I mustn't see. Satan, get thee behind me. He promised to wait, but I won't appear, and he may come here. Satan, he's at my gate. Get thee behind me. Stay where you are. It's too late. End quote. Now, the message is clear. Resistance to temptation is futile. Harry's, you know, back and forth. Do I? Will I? Won't I? Okay, Satan, never mind. Stay where you are in front of me. It's too late. So, you know, here's temptation, and what happens? Oh, well, too bad. It's futile. And you can also look at other songs of the period. 6 years later, there's 1942, a song, That Old Black Magic. You know, I mean, why would you want to be into black magic? So anyway, there's a certain conditioning that that follows this. 2 years after Follow the Fleet, in February of 1938, you have Theodore Adorno. Now, he's, you know, one of these Frankfurt School in Germany guys. He was made in that year, 38, chief of the music division of Princeton University's radio project, which was funded by the, guess who, Rockefeller Foundation. Adorno, what he believed and how he was going to use this, he believed that if you have repetition in music in other areas, then that can create popularity. You know, do something over and over and over and over again, you know, drum it into somebody's head. And that makes it popular. People go around whistling, da-da-da-da, you know, the song over and over again. And that you could actually change a culture that way, away from what he called the authoritarian personality. Now, what he meant by that was belief in traditional authority. He wants to get the country away from that. No more traditional authority. And he wanted to move the country toward what he called the revolutionary. And he meant by that liberating individuals from traditional values. And he also believed that the mass media, not just music alone, but the mass media could be used for, quote, opinion management. You could actually condition people's opinions. You know, will I think this or that about something? You could actually condition and control that. So now, 3 years later, 1941, Adorno leaves the radio project, and he moves out west to California, to the University of California, Los Angeles, and he teaches there for about 7 years, till 1948. And he teams with Max Horkheimer in 1947 to author a book called Dialectic of Enlightenment. Now, remember what I said. The whole plan, you know, you got your thesis, your antithesis, your synthesis. economics, politics, you know, whatever it is. So here you have the dialectic of enlightenment. Now, who's Horkheimer? Horkheimer was director of the Frankfurt School, not just a member, but director of the Frankfurt School during that 30s period. And Horkheimer believed that authority within the family structure is a serious problem. You've got to eliminate it. You know, dad and mom in control? No, no, that's bad. That's bad. Authority within the family structure is bad, he said. So in 1947, he's a busy boy. He doesn't just co-author that book. He also authors, as Horkheimer, The Eclipse of Reason. And in 1950, 3 years later, his co-author there in 47, Adorno, he authors a book called The Authoritarian Personality. And in that book, Adorno indicates that those who emphasize their family or their nation or their race actually have a psychiatric disorder. I mean, if you're for America, something's wrong with you. you got a mental problem. And so Adorno, he also theorized that an emphasis on fractious music could help destabilize society. Now think about it. Have you ever heard any fractious music over the last 40 years? And so one of the things that's inserted here is, if you look at it, it's a very long thing, but it's worth it. There's a DVD called They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll. And it's very enlightening. And I'm not going to go through all of that, but I've included here some separate information that you may or may not find in this DVD for your information. In 1951, this is right after these guys have authored these books, what you have, and it's not by accident, you have this Ohio disc jockey named Alan Freed, and he comes up with this phrase called rock and roll. Now, if you, read what he says about it, there's sexual connotations there. I mean, he's very clear about what he's talking about. So what you have is rock and roll placed a heavy emphasis on the beat and rhythm. You would actually hear people say, yeah, man, I like the beat, man. Yeah, they'd be talking like that, the beat. And so what are they doing? Well, I looked at a famous composer and conductor at that period, Dmitri Tiomkin. And he said that, quote, the big beat is deliberately aimed at exciting the listener. There is actually very little melody, only rhythm. We seem to be reverting to savagery. Youngsters who listen constantly to this sort of sound are thrust into turmoil. They are no longer relaxed, normal kids, end quote. And if you think about it, in the 50s, what did they start doing? People used to dance together, but now they were sort of separating, right? Individuals, they were sort of close, but they were really separate, not really together, relaxing, all these, jumping around and jerking all over the place. And so Tiomkin's analysis was actually supported by Aldous Huxley. Now, sometimes these guys, Aldous and his brother Julian, they were very open. This is what we're doing. Julian would talk about, eugenics. Great, world government, sure. So Aldous is very open. He writes a book in 1952 called The Devils of Loudun, and he says there, quote, if exposed long enough to the tom-toms and the singing, every one of our philosophers would end up by capering and howling with the savages. Assemble a mob of men and women previously conditioned by daily reading of newspapers, treat them to amplified band music and bright lights, and in next to no time, you can reduce them to a state of almost mindless subhumanity.
And that's what we see with a lot of these music festivals that they had, during the days of the hippies. And these people, tens of thousands of them, almost wild, frantic, swaying, totally consumed with the music and the beat and the drum beat, just like the drum beats we have in so many of our churches today.
Right. And his final statement in the quote is the purpose of all this. He says, never before have so few been in a position to make fools, maniacs, or criminals of so many, end quote. And so what do we have? We have a bunch of dummies and increasing crime and so on. So anyway, that's what Aldous said. In 1933, in The Shape of Things to Come by H.G. Wells, who also would foretell a lot of stuff, among the things that he foretold then in 1933 was that there would be this Second World War about 6-7 years after that, which was correct. And he said, after that, there would be growing criminally infected areas. Now, how did he know? Well, he's part of the, the elite and the planners of all this stuff. So anyway, scientifically supporting what Tiomkin and Huxley had said, in the late 50s, it's 5 years after Huxley's book, there was a book authored by Dr. William Sargent. Now, Sargent was a former president of the section of psychiatry at the Royal Society of Medicine, that's in London, and the book he authored was Battle for the Mind, subtitled The Mechanics of Indoctrination, Brainwashing, and Thought Control. And in there, he revealed, quote, that electrical recordings of the human brain show that it is particularly sensitive to rhythmic stimulation by percussion, that's the beat, and bright lights. Certain rates of rhythm can build up reportable abnormalities of brain function and explosive states. Furthermore, it is easier to disorganize the normal function of the brain by attacking it simultaneously with several strong rhythms played in different tempos, end quote. And that's what they've done. Sargent goes on and states after that, quote, belief can be implanted in people after brain function has been sufficiently disturbed by accidentally or deliberately induced fear, anger, or excitement. Of the results caused by such disturbances, the most common one is temporarily impaired judgment and heightened suggestibility, end quote. In other words, you plant stuff in people's minds. Now, 3 years after he wrote that book, is when the Beatles were formed, 1960. And that was sort of a transition from rock and roll to rock music. And they you know, went further and further. So by 1967, in their Sgt. Pepper album, there were definite drug implications in that album. And in case you think, you know, I'm some wacko right-winger who's imagining stuff, even the UN Bulletin on Narcotics warned about that, the drug implications in the Sgt. Pepper album. In 1962, 2 years after the Beatles, you have the formation of the Rolling Stones. They formed, and Mick Jagger and his crew is still around today. So they've been very, very popular for a long time. And in fact, I think Mac Lauer on NBC's Today Show said, oh, yeah, I love the Stones. I love the Stones. Well, you've got to remember who these guys are. They wrote the Rolling Stones songs like Sympathy for the Devil. And they had albums such as, the title of it was Their Satanic Majesty's Request. Now, how can you like a group like that? So in the mid-60s, this became a period of increasing revolution. See, there's that word. That's what they want. Against traditional values. In 1964, you had a group called The Who formed. And one of its members proclaimed, quote, what we dish out is the musical equivalent of war. War upon quiet, war upon dullness, war upon certainty and stability, end quote. And that same year, another group formed, Mothers of Invention. And its leader's name was Frank Zappa, and he said, quote, the loud sounds and bright lights of today are tremendous indoctrination tools, quote. And the very next year, 1965, you had another group forming called the Jefferson Airplane. And one of the members, Paul Cantor, he revealed, quote, the new rock music is intended to broaden the generation gap, alienate parents from their children, and prepare young people for revolution, end quote. The next year, 1966, you have another group, Crosby, Stills, and Nash. They meet for the first time. They don't formally form until 68, but they meet in 66. And David Crosby in the magazine Rolling Stone, this is volume one, he remarked, quote, I figured the only thing to do was to steal their kids. I still think it's the only thing to do. By saying that, I'm not talking about kidnapping. I'm just talking about changing young people's value systems, which removes them from their parents' world effectively, end quote. So this isn't just, you know, my imagination. I try to give these quotes by these groups, these leading popular groups of the day, showing what they're up to. You know, separate the kids from their parents. Let's have a revolution. We're going to change the values. Now, one of the important areas of American values that was under attack at that time in the 60s was religion. Traditional biblical values were undermined and basically replaced by a couple of religious thrusts of the day. You had the early 60s, Secular humanism, it had been around for a long time, but it really got going then. Also in the 60s, what was called, or came to be known as, the New Age. Songs expressing situation ethics, attitudes of that time in the 60s, like do your own thing, man, if it feels good, do it. That's, those sorts of things promoted the religion of secular humanism. You know, situation ethics, there is no God, I should do whatever I want to based on the situation, so on. Do my own thing. And in 1967, you had a musical that was introduced called Hair. And it opened at that time, 67, and included a popular song from the musical called Aquarius. And that particular number and musical promoted the New Age religion. And it contained, this particular song, Aquarius, it contained the following lyrics. When the moon is in the seventh house, and I include these words in my book now, it's the dawning of the New Age, New World Order. When the moon is in the seventh house and Jupiter aligns with Mars, then peace will guide the planets and love will steer the stars. This is the dawning of the age of Aquarius. Harmony and understanding, sympathy and trust abounding, no more falsehoods or derision, golden living dreams of visions, mystic crystal revelation, and the mind's true liberation. Those are the lyrics. 2 years after the musical, you had a group called The Fifth Dimension, who introduced that particular song as a single. And if you look at the Theosophical New Age book, The Light Shall Set You Free, from 1996, well, I hear the music. We'll pick up after the break.
All right, fine. But, of course, there has been a progressive change in our society, and music's played an important part of it. These things did not happen by accident. They are being directed, at least in part, by these powerful occult forces. We talk about the Brotherhood of Darkness and the esoteric force behind it. Our guest, Dr. Dennis Cuddy, will be back in just a moment to wrap up the program. Well, Dennis, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Okay, when you look at, I'll just back up to the lyrics of The Age of Aquarius. It goes, now is the dawning of the Age of Aquarius. The thing is, that wasn't just some isolated event, and they're actually re-bringing it back now. I think it's on Broadway now. You know, they're bringing it back because this is a critical time. Why is this a critical time? Well, if you look at the 1996 Theosophical New Age book called The Light Shall Set You Free, this is by two individuals, Norma Milanovic and Shirley McCune. And remember, the theosophists believe that Lucifer is the light bearer. See, he brings the light. He's good, you know. Not that bad old Adonai, the judgmental god. Lucifer is the good one, see. Light bringer, knowledge, you know, let me have more light. They believe sets you free, as opposed to the biblical statement that the truth, Jesus, will make you free. You know, not Jesus, the angel of light. Remember, Satan, Lucifer can come as an angel of light. Well, that's the way they present it. Theosophists present that. That's why a number of their publications are by Lucifer Publishing, or the actually titled Lucifer. And so these two people, Norma Milanovic and Shirley McCune, in there you read, quote, the date for entry into the fifth dimension. Remember, that's the singing group, 1969, now is the dawning of the Age of Aquarius. The entry into the fifth dimension, and that, what is the fifth dimension? Well, that's when the Piscean or Christian, you know, fish or Christian age will end and the Age of Aquarius will begin, is scheduled for the year 2012. See? That's why they're bringing this thing back. It'll be the final year of the Obama's first presidential term, 2012. See, they're gearing up. Everything's in sync here. You got the politics, the economics, the globalization, the Socialist International, and you can't forget the religious element. That's why they're coming back with Hair, the New Age, all of this one-world religion, the synthesis. Remember the word synthesis when you're talking politics, economics, whatever? Synthesis of all these religions melded into this one-world religion, including the New Age, some pantheism, and certainly not God of the Bible. No. That's bad. That's bad. You have to have this this liberation where you have light. And, you know, that'll be Lucifer, the light bringer, and so he's good according to these, the theosophists and so on. So this is all timed, all on schedule, looking towards, 2012 as the beginning of the Age of Aquarius and this fifth dimension. So, get ready for your future, and, That's the role of music anyway, up until this part. This is part one. Next time we'll get into part two of music, but now you see what their plan is.
Hold that thought. Well, thanks so much. We'll look forward to part two. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and we do hope that you enjoyed our conversation with Dr. Dennis Cuddy. And you have to understand that we are living in momentous times. Everything is in place. Obama, President Obama, was chosen long ago by the people who worship the other God. And believe me, there really are millions of people who worship Lucifer here in the United States. And of course, they're not going to tell you this, but we have a wonderful DVD called The Emergence with Constance Cumby, the talk she gave at our conference. And then, of course, we have a four CD set with Constance Cumby called The Aquarian Conspiracy. And you really need to get this information to understand what's going on. And then let me suggest my talk on the financial Armageddon, and the syllabus goes with that. But in that talk, we of course quote extensively from a woman named Corrine McLaughlin and her husband Gordon Davidson, both affiliated with the Lucius Trust. It used to be the Lucifer Publishing House. Now it's called the Lucius Trust. And you go up there, they will tell you, of course, that Lucifer really has gotten a bad rap. He's really not such a bad guy. But then, of course, they will you will actually see what they wrote about Barack Obama. Did you know that people all throughout the world were praying Barack Obama would become the President of the United States so he could facilitate moving us into this wonderful new age? I'm not pulling a leg. This is it. We have their publications, but we first give them to you in extensive detail in my talk on the financial Armageddon. Everything you are witnessing has been planned. The whole financial collapse has been planned for a long time. And, of course, if you really think that things are going to get better just because the stock market's going up, you don't understand that you do not have a recovery unless you have jobs. You don't have jobs unless you have production. You don't have production unless you have credit. And the occult forces that control the banking system have cut off credit and made it so extremely expensive that, of course, many of our major corporations are going to fail in the coming years. And the market is going to simply collapse very, very soon. It may come back again, but we are in a long-term bear market, and millions more are going to lose their homes. Millions more are going to lose their jobs. We are in for terrible times, but that is as it's planned, for we are entering into the time of Aquarius. Well, our telephone number, of course, is, if you'd like to get the items I mentioned, Chris Pinto's DVD on the Atlantis Connection, Constance Cumby, The Emergence, or her four CD set of The Aquarian Conspiracy. And then, of course, you need to get my talk on the financial Armageddon, and the syllabus goes with that. Our number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, our webpage is radioliberty.com. You need to, of course, get out of debt, begin making preparations for the very difficult times. I'm not a stock market advisor, but if you can possibly get out of the stock market, and anything that's mediated in dollars at least will help you during this time. But understand, behind everything are powerful spirits of forces. So make sure that you have a personal relationship with our Lord, and if you do not know how to do that, let me suggest Pastor Billy Crone's talks on the financial meltdown, because he ends each one with an invitation to turn your life over to our Lord. The final countdown, part one is 5 DVDs, part two is 5 DVDs. We think he does an excellent job. And, of course, you need to understand the signs of the times, they're all here. We actually have the first 5 of his talks in something, in a 5 CD set called The Countdown to Armageddon. And believe me, it's coming very rapidly. We're heading into more wars and famine and pestilence and disease and a chaotic situation. It's not nice to say it, but I would not be doing my job if I didn't tell you that terrible times lie ahead. certainly make sure you're in a personal relationship with our Lord, and then pray for America. Pray for revival, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until Monday, may the Lord be with you.